You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and this past week we had off-year elections in various states and cities that are being analyzed for their impact on the midterm elections next year and beyond, including the presidential race. Joining me today to review the results and their implications for the future is Hal Malchow, who's a legend in Democratic circles for his pioneering work on data analytics and targeting long before they became fashionable in politics. Al is also a former resident of Virginia, so this is one of the states that had an election of importance this past week. So his thoughts will be very interesting, I think, on national elections, national politics, and moving forward. Hal, thanks so much for being on Heartland Politics today.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you lived quite a while in Virginia there. In fact, when I met you, you were there out in the suburban area. And this was an election that got a lot of notice this week. Normally, they may not have as much. But, of course, the Republican won, winning that race. It was a close race in a state that people thought had been trending Democratic. What do you think happened there?
Well, I think our problem is not the popularity of what we have been advocating. Our problem is our failure as a governing party. We didn't produce an infrastructure bill until after Virginia. We are fighting more among ourselves than we are fighting with Republicans. And we've been given the reins of government, and we've shown unsteady hands.
So the timing of this, so you think that if they would have passed, and as we're taping this, it looks like the Democrats are moving some of this legislation through the House anyway, but do you think if they would have passed this infrastructure bill and then as well as the Build Back Better bill with all the social spending, that might have had a positive impact in Virginia from Collis?
Well, it certainly would have helped. I mean, I just think we don't look like a party with a shared vision and an ability to make things happen.
I mean, that's a tough one because it does seem like I saw a recent article by Jerry Seib, I believe, in the Wall Street Journal that talked about there's now four parties. The Democrats have the progressives and the moderates. The Republicans have those loyal to Trump and then those the old conservative line. It just seems like the Democratic Party seems a lot more ideologically diverse, and it's harder to bring them together.
Well, yeah, that's true. There's certainly more division in this country than there ever have been in any time I can remember, and I just turned 70 this week. I think it's harder to get consensus and to build majorities because of all the outside factors. You know, back in the old days, we had three networks, and they all told us the same thing, and everybody agreed on the facts. But today, it's not like that at all. And when you have very narrow majorities, several things happen. One, if you need every Democrat in the House to pass a piece of legislation, particularly a large piece of legislation, that's very hard to do. It also empowers people on the edge. You know, in the Senate, you've got Kirsten Cimino from Arizona, who opposes rolling back the tax cuts that Trump imposed. She's suddenly in a position of great power. And people are tempted to be obstructionists when their one vote can make the difference. You have the problem of a very narrow majority, and you have the problem of no ideological consensus within it's closer to an ideological consensus inside the Republican Party, I think, than it is in the Democratic Party today.
Congresswoman Spanberger from Virginia said this week after the election that perhaps the mistake the Biden administration is making is that they're trying to govern like FDR and perhaps some of the progressive allies and going for sweeping changes here and not maybe going for incremental change, which might be what she recommends. It's apparently because of the very tight majority in the House and then 50-50 split in the Senate with the vice president breaking the tie.
I definitely think that it's a mistake to take all of these different things, many of which are individually very popular, throw them into one large piece of legislation that no one understands. The only thing anyone understands about it is that the initial proposal was $3 trillion, which is a frightening number. Mm-hmm. And I would like to speak to that more in this podcast about how our legislative strategy can be reshaped to give things a better chance of passing, but also to get the Republicans on record on a lot of the popular proposals we're putting out there.
I want to get to that as well. It just seemed like, you know, Virginia had gone 10 points for Biden, and New Jersey was another state that had a governor's race where the incumbent barely won.
I barely remember when Republicans had much of a chance. You know, I guess Christie was the last Republican governor, but New Jersey's, Virginia is a purple state that is turning blue, but New Jersey has been blue for a long time. It's basically irrelevant in presidential elections.
So it seemed like, too, the school of thought is that the Republicans just ran better campaigns than the Democratic candidates. From your perspective, did you Youngkin was focused on local issues, the schools and a food sales tax there, things like that. Do you think that helped or in the way he navigated the relationship with Donald Trump?
You know, I don't live in Virginia anymore, so I was not seeing the ads and a lot of the campaign dialogue up close. But I'm sure for a Republican candidate for governor of Virginia, moving it away from trying to denationalize the election, which I think is very difficult to do these days, but trying to denationalize the elections was a very smart strategy.
Let's move into what your recent thoughts have been on how the Democrats need to, because it's very relevant, I think, to what happened this week. And just share a bit, if you would, your contention on how the Democrats are falling short and what they need to be doing message-wise, strategy-wise.
Yeah, the politics has changed a lot, and we've been doing the same thing for 70 years. Let me start with the first point. The first point is that people are voting for parties, not candidates these days. There's a Republican firm, Public Opinion Strategies, that has been polling the American electorate since 2000 to measure the number of ticket splitters, the percentage of voters who actually vote for candidates of two different parties. In the year 2000, when they started, 36% of the electorate were ticket splitters. In 2020, that number had fallen to 11%. So basically, 90% of the voters are choosing parties, not candidates. Yet we spend 100% of our campaign money on candidate ads. And if people are choosing parties and 90% are voting straight tickets, we need to be speaking to the differences in the parties. And to the extent we do that, this is advantageous for Democrats because, one, our proposals are more popular, and two, the Republican Party as an opposition party, I think, has been reckless in ways that ought to be causing them a lot of problems. But lots of the voters don't have the details to understand. So the first thing is we have to think about how we advertise and shape messages for the party and not the candidates. The candidates will raise their own money. They'll do you know, their own ads, but the party and these super PACs and these other entities that are spending large amounts of elections need to be addressing the differences in the parties. The second thing that we need to do is we need to break away from the old formula of raising all our money and then holding it till September and October of the election year and then start messaging. So let me give you some examples of some opportunities that we have had this year and squandered. The first is the stimulus bill. So 85% of American households got a $1,400 stimulus check. You know, I would assume somewhere close to 100% of them were happy about it, but 100% of Republican senators voted against it. Oh, and I'm sure that next October, you know, there'll be ads about the Republicans voting against their stimulus check. But excuse me, you know, the time to do that is when they're getting the checks. The you know, that's an emotional moment. They get this check and they find out that they're that all Republican senators voted against this. We have a number of other examples. 70% of voters in this country believe that the 2020 election was fairly decided. Now, when they certified the election, there was a lot of news content going on. You had the January 6th insurrection. You had the members of Congress were shuttled to safety. You had all these things going on. But I think there's one thing that got lost in the news, and that was the fact that 80% of Republican members of the House voted to overturn the election, an election that 70% of Americans thought was fairly decided. You know, here's some other examples. You've got hold on a sec.
Go right ahead.
You've got the investigation of the January 6th insurrection. The Republicans basically refused to participate. Most Americans wanted that investigation carried out. And there was a poll, really interesting poll to me, because I thought, oh, this kind of counters the sense of polarization in this country. The poll said basically more than 70% of voters listed as one of their very top priorities that Republicans and Democrats start working together for the good of the country. But we have a video now of Mitch McConnell basically saying the number one and only objective of the Republican Party is to stop everything that Joe Biden wants to get done. Why was that not put on the air for people to see? They've been getting away with a lot of very controversial things and behavior, while we've done nothing to they're in a lot of trouble. They have an erratic ex-president who is who's creating all kinds of problems and doing irresponsible things, but we are not holding them accountable. And if we could break the if we could break the old formula of waiting until September and October of the election year to have anything to say and speak to these things while they're happening and while they're in the news cycle, then I think we could be a lot more effective.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is a legendary political consultant in the Democratic Party, Hal Malchow, who recently relocated, well, maybe not recently, but from Virginia to New Mexico, where we took a little look at what happened in the elections last week. And it kind of leads into a thesis Hal has about how the Democrats need to shift strategy on reaching out to voters. And it's more appealing on a party basis versus an individual candidate basis. Because as he just pointed out, the Democrats agree on several, most voters agree on several issues he outlined of critical importance. I guess I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit, because I've seen the polls too, and on a lot of issues, voters do seem to support the Democratic view on those issues. However, it seems that especially in rural and working class areas, the brand is just toxic of the Democratic Party, and it seems like they view these issues through the prism of the party, and you can't even get to them on the issues because they reject anybody with a D behind their name. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And you know, what you have to understand is that this battle between Democrats and Republicans is not about economic issues. You know, if you looked at the economic policies of the Democrats, you know, making it easier to get health care, amending the tax code so that those who make less money are paying less taxes, and those who make more are paying more. Your family leave, child care, all of these things that benefit exactly many of the Trump voters. The problem is, this is a culture war. It's not an economic war. And part of our problem comes from, you know, what James Carville spoke to this a few days ago. He said we need to send some of our party members to woke detoxification camps. Our language, when we say things like defund the police, you know, we're really hurting ourselves. And I don't know how you get some of these people under control, but it's a really difficult problem. The basically, you've got a class of people who've sort of lost out economically. You know, there's no longer all these great manufacturing jobs. In these rural areas, the unemployment problems the unemployment is high. The addiction problems are widespread. You've got, these are the only places where life expectancy is, declining, and they do have things to be angry about. But they're really angry because they feel like the elites, which constitute much of the Democratic Party, are looking down on them, and we may offer them better economic programs, but you know, they've sort of put that aside, and I think they like Trump because they know that the elites hate him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a hard one for the Democrats to crack, because that school of thought that the working class voters don't vote their interests when they vote Republican. I feel like it's somewhat repugnant, because I feel like that maybe their interests don't align with economic issues. And you're basically saying that their focus is more on the cultural issues where they're more hostile to Democrats.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, some Democrats make this problem much worse by using language. And you know, there was a recent poll that was published in The Atlantic and in and National Review, both, that said basically 80% of Americans think that political correctness is a serious problem for the country.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And we are the party of political correctness.
We are the party, yeah, the Democrat. So I'm curious, and this gets into an area that I'm a little bit familiar with too, with my experience in politics. But you've got an idea that sounds compelling. Have you tried to sell this within the Democratic Party, and what's kind of the response so far?
I've spent 5 years trying to get a meeting at the DNC to talk about this, and have been completely unsuccessful. You know, I've taken this message. Finally, I said, well, you know, I have to get on Twitter. I have to write some stuff. I had an article in The Hill, and I had an interview in the in Salon. But I'm trying to get this message out. Hopefully, create some support and just get people to look at it. You know, when I started the movement to change how we did our targeting in campaigns. This took about 12 years. Politics, particularly campaign politics, is an innovation-averse business. You know, you've got this table, and you've got the media consultant, the pollster, and the mail consultant, the research, and the internet, and everyone's got their piece of the pie. And anything that changes the formula threatens everybody. So, so there's often resistance. You know, I mean, what I tried to do in with data analytics was pretty simple. The idea was, okay, if you know a lot of information about the individual, and you can predict whether or not that how likely that individual is to vote and how likely that individual is to be a Democrat, this is a better way to pick the voters that we want to talk to than using precinct targeting, which is the average of 500 voters. You know, to me, that was a 30-second conversation, but it turned out to be a 12-year battle. And you know, this may be the same way. It may take some time, but you know, the simple piece of this is 90% of the voters are choosing parties. And if 90% of the voters are choosing parties, we need to speak to that decision as opposed to talking to 10% who are choosing candidates.
Well, I think what you say has merit. It's except in some areas. I mean, it's like, again, the rural areas, it's going to be really hard. And
it will be hard. But, you know, I think there's a tendency to think that, okay, if we're going to win, we have to do much better in the areas where we are absolutely weakest. And I think that is not where we're going to win the most votes. Where we're going to win the most votes is in the suburbs and in places where things have been trending our way as opposed to away from us.
And the suburbs are an area that flipped big time in Virginia and New Jersey.
Yep.
Against the Democrats.
That's right. Getting those people back is much easier for the Democrats than going into these depleted rural areas that are very religious and just hold, you know, different values for most of our party members.
But the problem I see, Hal, though, is that the bottom keeps dropping out in rural areas. I mean, my students were looking at that this week where McAuliffe won a suburban county but by a pretty good margin, but three of the rural counties where McAuliffe only got 15% of the vote counteracted that.
Yep.
It seems like they've got to do something out in the rural areas in order to just keep the bottom from being so low that where these huge margins add up.
Yeah, I think generally, you know, facts can change things, but generally the best opportunities are not in your weakest areas. You know, the people who are easiest to change are the ones you want to focus on.
So in the suburbs, again, it seemed like one group in the suburbs that really flipped was women. And some of it had to do with education. There's different narratives out there about critical race theory, about kids when they were at home during the pandemic and parents not liking what they were hearing on how their kids were being taught. Is that an issue you think that might have legs next year in the midterm elections?
Yeah, sure. And it's reflective of the cultural context. Conflict that's taking place in this country. Yeah, so I think it will be important. I think it will be an effective issue. And it won't probably, in most places, it won't be a great issue for Democrats.
I want to close on one question. I want to go back and just share with our listeners the significance of your work that you've done. We've got a couple minutes left here, but what's one thing you did, I guess, going back in your career that you thought made the most significant contribution to how campaigns are run and to help the candidates and the party that you believe in?
Well, I think the biggest thing was helping found the Analyst Institute, which is an organization that conducts control group experiments to measure the effectiveness of things we do in campaigns. And the Analyst Institute today, it has 30 staff members. It conducts, in a election year, an even numbered year, probably an average of 1,000 experiments. And what we've learned about what works and not works has been very surprising, and it's completely transformed how we approach voter turnout, and to a lesser extent, how we approach persuasion. So to me, that was my biggest accomplishment, or certainly my biggest influence on how campaigns are conducted.
I would just add to our listeners, if they're interested in this, how experiments have impacted politics, they should go pick up Sasha Eisenberg's book called The Victory Lab. Hal plays a very major role in that. In fact, I use that book. I'm using it right now to teach my students. It was revolutionary to look at politics the way other industries, where what works and what doesn't. And, of course, that's a threat to some of the folks that are the incumbent consultants that are in there, and Hal's been a warrior in challenging existing structure.
No, it's a little bit scandalous that all these experiments that have transformed our the way we conduct campaigns began not within our industry, but by a couple of professors from Yale who did it for academic purposes. But they got our attention, and you know, the first things I did when I heard about them was to bring them to Washington and have them talk to a lot of key leaders. But I'm very proud of the fact that that we were able to do this and now have fairly deep knowledge about a lot of things that worked. I would say once we did these experiments, about 80% of everything we were doing for voter turnout was worthless, and we changed how we did it.
And I'll add that the Republicans have been doing this as well. Professors were involved with Rick Perry's gubernatorial races. So
that's right. Well, one of the two that influenced the Democrats a lot, Don Green, he helped Perry's campaign.
Interesting battle behind the scenes between the use of experiments to find out what works, and it's a part of what makes politics really interesting these days. Hal, thank you so much for being a guest today. It's very educational. I hope our listeners learned some things. I know I did. I always do when I talk to you. Hal Malchow is, a pioneer in campaign techniques as a consultant going back years, and he took a look a little bit today at the election results this week and then talked about his thoughts on how the Democrats can do better in this era of hyper polarization. Hal, thank you again for being my guest.
Thank you, Robin. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.